You know, nobody but nobody knows how to make lemonade from being handed a lemon more than the Lord God of Israel. You're going to see what I mean by that shortly. In Joshua chapter 10, we're going to find that the unholy treaty that Israel had been tricked into making with Gibeon would lead to both conflict and opportunity for God's people. Joshua chapter 10, this is a story of the conquest of the southern part of Canaan, geographically speaking. And chapter 11 then is going to take us into the battles for the northern parts of Canaan, geographically. Now, up to now, Israel had really not made any serious headway in occupying the Promised Land. They had two battles up to this point, Jericho and Ai. And both battles served the divine purpose of educating Israel about the very nature of holy war, the necessity of being scrupulously obedient to their divine warrior leader, Yehovah, what happened when they were, and even more important, what happened when they weren't, and never counting upon just their own strength, but rather on the power of the Lord if they wanted victory. Now, I want to pause for a few minutes and review some of the ground rules and principles that make Joshua understandable and full of meaning for us today. And the first thing I want you to notice is that if we want to grasp the rationale for the exacting methods and procedures that the Lord ordered Joshua to follow when he was conquering Canaan, we're going to find it in the God patterns that were set down and defined in the Torah. Holy war was being waged. And because it was holy war, there were God-ordained procedures to follow. And central to these procedures that Israel would adhere to in their battle for the land of Canaan was the law of Harem, the law of the ban. And central to the law of Harem was the concept of holy property. Property that had been set apart, banned, devoted, exclusively for the God of Israel. This is holy property. The particular property in question was, of course, always the property that had formerly belonged to the enemy. In other words, we would call it spoils of war. The property, the spoils, could literally be anything. It could be people, cattle, buildings, gold and silver, garments, food, furniture, cooking pots, anything. And the Lord decided which of the enemy's property that they had just defeated, he wanted for himself. And then the remainder, Israel could distribute among themselves. Now, the property that the Lord deemed as exclusively his, then, instantly gained the status of holy property. All other property that was not devoted to God was therefore left in its common state. It didn't attain holy status, and was therefore suitable for the Hebrew people to use for themselves. Now, theoretically, the Lord could decide this on a case-by-case basis. And as Joshua conquered city after city, which property the Lord wanted devoted for himself would be determined. But before Israel even began the Battle of Canaan, the Lord established a general rule about these spoils that he wanted set aside for himself. In every case, he wanted as a minimum the enemy cities, that is literally the structures, and the enemy people. The Lord wanted the Canaanites' fortifications, their dwelling places, their temples to the gods. He also wanted the Canaanites themselves. And the way he claimed his holy property was that it was to be destroyed by Israel's army rather than left intact for human use. If the holy property was buildings, then they were leveled and they were burned. If the holy property was people, they were killed and usually left to burn in the smoldering rubble of the city where they died. Therefore, the law of Harem operates within the pattern, catch this, it operates within the God pattern of sacrificial offerings that the Lord had established early on in the Torah. That is, an animal is devoted, it's designated as the sacrificial offering to God. So what happens to it? It instantly becomes holy property. In order for the Lord to claim that holy property, then, the animal is killed and then burned up on the brazen altar. And if grain was part of that offering, it too was killed, so to speak, by being harvested, taken off the plant, and then prepared by being ground up or mixed in with some other specific ingredients. And then once offered, it too was burned up. It was destroyed, if you would, on the altar fire. But in the first two battles for Canaan, Jericho and Ai, another key God pattern was followed, the principle of first fruits. Jericho being the first Canaanite city and group of people that would be conquered in the conquest was therefore the first fruits. The law of first fruits is best explained, and the law for new orchards and new vineyards, whereby none of the fruit can be plucked or in any way used in the first 3 years after they've been planted. The law of Moses says that in the fourth year, the fruit produced is to be harvested, but all of it is to be devoted to God. Then in the fifth year, the second year, in other words, that the fruit can be harvested, in the fifth year then, the first part of the fruit, the tithe, that's given to God, but all the remainder now can be eaten by the people. So Jericho, being the first fruits of Canaan, metaphorically speaking, what happens to the first of the first fruits? It all goes to God. The people of Israel can have no part of it. And thus the order that everything in Jericho had to be destroyed and burned up, including what would usually be considered spoils of war that typically went to the army. Of course, we recently read in Joshua how one man, Achan, violated God's principle. And boy, that caused a lot of trouble for him and his family and, in fact, all of Israel. But the city of Ai, the second of the first fruits of Canaan, God wanted only his part. See how this tracks? Just his part. The people and the structures. The remainder of the spoils of war go to Israel. See, it's patterns. It's always patterns that we want to be looking for as we go through God's word. Now, as we begin chapter 10, Israel has made a major misstep, and it wasn't their first. At Ai, the people of Israel determined from their easy success at Jericho that this whole business of holy war and conquering Canaan, man, this is going to be a piece of cake. So they didn't bother to consult God before entering the battle for Ai. And as a result, they were handed a resounding defeat. And after understanding where the problem lay, that was Achan's sin plus Israel's sin of arrogance and disobedience and not first seeking the Lord, Israel repented. They regained favor with God, so the Lord handed over Ai to them. But almost immediately, Israel messed up again. This time, they fell victim to a plan by another group of Canaanites from an area called Gibeon. Now, these Gibeonites, the people who lived in Gibeon, feared that they would be annihilated by Israel. They had heard all about what had happened down in Egypt. They had heard about what happened to the kings of the Transjordan. They had heard about Ai and Jericho. And just as interesting, they had heard of the order from Israel's God that all the people of the region of Canaan were to be driven out or destroyed. Gibeon occupying territory in the promised land meant they were marked for termination one way or another. So rather than leave the area or fight a losing battle with Israel, they decided on another tact. They would send ambassadors to Joshua and claim they had come from a land far away, outside of Canaan. They wanted to make a treaty with Israel. They wanted to be at peace, but they also wanted to be under the protection of Israel's enormous military. Now, this was perfectly allowable, by the way, under the Torah. Now, the leaders of Israel, figuring that this was just kind of a mundane political matter, again did not seek the advice of the Lord. Big mistake. It turned out the Gibeonites were lying about where they were from. Israel made a treaty with Gibeon, which by definition always includes a vow to God. And then 3 days later, they find out the whole thing is a sham. The leaders of Israel discussed it, and they decided that they had to decide between committing the lesser of two evils. Either they keep their vow to the Lord and thus remain at peace with Gibeon, or they obey God's instruction handed down through Moses that all the people were to be driven out of the Holy Land or killed without exception, and that included Gibeon. They decided that their vow was more important, and now they were stuck with the results. Of course, they also seemed to dismiss the reality that from this moment forward, they were operating in rebellion and sin because they did not obliterate this Canaanite people called Gibeon. Let's read Joshua 10 and see how this conundrum plays out. Joshua chapter 10. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 251. When Adonai-Sedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had taken Ai and utterly destroyed it, he had done the same to Ai and its king as he had done to Jericho and its king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were living among them, his people became greatly alarmed, because Gibeon was as large as one of the royal cities, larger than Ai, and all of its men were courageous. So Adonai-Sedek, king of Jerusalem, sent this message to Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Yarmut, Japhia, king of Lachish, and Dvir, king of Eglon. Come up, help me, and we'll attack Gibeon, because it has made peace with Joshua and the people of Israel. So the five kings of the Amorites, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Yarmut, Lachish, and Eglon, they got together. And they went up with all their armies and pitched camp against Gibeon and made war against it. Now the people of Gibeon sent a message to Joshua at their camp in Gilgal that said, "Don't ignore your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Help us, because all the kings of the Amorites living in the hills have gotten together to fight us." Well, Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the fighting men with him, including all the bravest ones. And Adonai said to Joshua, "Don't be afraid of them, for I have handed them over to you. Not one of their men will stand against you." Well, having spent the entire night marching up from Gilgal, Joshua fell before them, taking them by surprise, and Adonai threw them into confusion before Israel. He defeated them in a great slaughter at Gibeon, pursuing them along the road that goes up from Beth Horon and beating them back to Azekah and all the way to Makkedah. And as they fled before Israel down the road to Beth Horon, Adonai threw huge hailstones down on them all the way to the Azekah, and they died. More died because of the hail than because Israel had killed them with the sword. Then on the day Adonai handed over the Amorites to the people of Israel, Joshua spoke to Adonai in sight of Israel. He said, "Sun, stand motionless over Gibeon. Moon, you too, over the Ayalon Valley." So the sun stood still and the moon stayed put till Israel took vengeance on their enemies. Now this is written in the book of Yashar. The sun stood still in the sky and was in no rush to set for nearly a whole day. There has never been a day like that before or since, when Adonai listened to the voice of a man. It happened because Adonai was fighting on Israel's behalf. Well, Joshua returned with all Israel to the camp at Gilgal, but those five kings fled, and they hid themselves in the cave at Makkedah. And it was reported to Joshua that the five kings had been found hiding in the cave of Makkedah. And Joshua said, well, roll big stones to the mouth of the cave and put men there to guard them. However, you don't wait. Keep chasing your enemies and attack those farthest from the rear. Don't allow them to return to their cities because Adonai has handed them over to you. Well, after Joshua and the people of Israel had finished killing them off in a very great slaughter, till they had been destroyed and the remaining remnant had entered the fortified cities, all the people returned safely to Joshua at the camp at Makkedah, and no one said a word against any of the people of Israel. And then Joshua said, open up the mouth of the cave and bring those five kings out of the cave to me. They did it. They brought the five kings out to him, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Yarmut, Lachish, and Eglon. And after they had brought the five kings to Joshua, he summoned all the men of Israel and said to the commanders of the soldiers that had gone with him, come here and put your feet on the necks of these kings. And they came and put their feet on their necks. And Joshua said to them, don't be afraid or confused, but be strong and bold, because this is what Adonai is going to do to all your enemies that fight against. And with that, Joshua struck them, put them to death, hanging them on five trees, where they remained hanging until evening. And at sunset, Joshua gave an order, and they lowered them from the trees and threw them into the cave where they had hidden themselves, and then they laid big stones at the mouth of the cave, and they remain there until this day. Now Joshua captured Makkedah that day, defeating it and its king by the sword. He completely destroyed them, everyone there. He left no one. And he did to the king of Makkedah what he had done to the king of Jericho. Well, Joshua went on from Makkedah, and all Israel with him, to Libnah. And he fought against Libnah. And Adonai also handed it and its king over to Israel. He defeated it with the sword, everyone there. He left no one. And he did to its king what he had done to the king of Jericho. Joshua went on from Libnah and all Israel with him to Lachish. And he pitched camp against it and he fought against it. And Adonai handed it over to Israel. He captured it the second day. He defeated it with the sword, everyone there, exactly as he had done to Libnah. Well, but then Horam, king of Gezer, came up to help Lachish. So Joshua attacked him and his people until he had no one left with him. Joshua went on from Lachish and all Israel with him to Eglon, and he pitched camp against it and fought against it, and they captured it that very day, and he defeated it with the sword, completely destroying everyone there, exactly as he'd done to Lachish. Well, Joshua went up from Eglon, all Israel with him, to Hebron, and there they fought against it. They captured it, defeating it with the sword, including its king, its villages, everyone there. He left no one, exactly as he had done to Eglon, but he completely destroyed it, everyone there. Joshua turned back and all Israel with him to Debir, and he fought against it. And they captured it, its king, its villages, defeating them with the sword and utterly destroying everyone there. He left no one. He did to Debir and its king as he had done to Hebron, and he had done to Libnah and its king. So Joshua attacked all the land, the hills, the Negev, the Shephelah, and the mountain slopes, and all their kings. He left none, but completely destroyed everything that breathed, as Adonai, the God of Israel, had ordered. Joshua attacked them from Kadesh Barnea to Gaza, all the land of Goshen, as far as Gibeon. Joshua captured all of these kings and their land all at the same time, because Adonai, the God of Israel, fought on Israel's behalf. And then Joshua returned, all Israel with him, to their camp at Gilgal. The matter of Gibeon making a peace treaty with Israel became known throughout the region very rapidly. It shook the other tribes and the nations who lived in the land of Canaan. So there was this fellow named Adonai Zedek who ruled over the city-state of Jerusalem at this time. Now, this is a good time to remind everyone, Jerusalem was not originally founded by Israel. Rather, it was King David who captured it and then made it his capital city. The best and earliest records give credit for the establishment of that city to the Jebusites. Now, just who the Jebusites were is a whole other matter. There's a lot of indication they were a sub-branch of the Amorites. Now, the first known name for the city that we now call Jerusalem was Jebus or Jebus. Now, Jebus is a Canaanite word. So the residents of Jebus were rightly called Jebusites, Jebusites. And in Aramaic and Arabic, that same place was called Salem. So Jebus and Salem were both very early recognized names for what we today call Jerusalem. Now in Genesis, we read of this mysterious Melchizedek, king and high priest of Salem, we were told, Jerusalem. Now, of course, this was a time around 600 years before the era of Joshua and the conquest of Canaan. So Jerusalem was already an old city by the time the Israelites arrived there. Now, notice the similarity between the two names, Melchizedek and Adonai-Sedek. The first translates literally to King of Righteousness. The second translates to Lord of Righteousness. In reality, they're synonymous terms. It was the tradition of the residents of Jebus to give all the kings of their city-state essentially the same name. And the name was really not a name. It was a title. And by way of example, what I mean by that, Yeshua, Jesus, is a formal name. Messiah, Christ, Savior, that is a title. Yehovah is a name. God is a title. Ramesses is a name. Pharaoh is a title. Adonai-Zedek was a title for the current king of Jebus, Jerusalem. We have no idea what his formal name was. Now, interestingly, it has been suspected, even in the days of antiquity, that Abraham may himself have actually been an Amorite, since they were a tribe or a nation or a culture that came from Mesopotamia. Abraham came from Mesopotamia. And if the suspicion that the people of Jebus, the Jebusites, were a branch of the Amorites, that would easily explain why Abraham would have been so familiar with Melchizedek, who was the king of the city of Jebus at that time. I mean, they may both have been from the tribe of the Amorites. That's not proved, but you know, it's a pretty reasonable speculation based on the evidence that we have. Now, the reason I even went there is to explain that we see the king of Jerusalem plus a five-nation coalition together go and attack Gibeon, and it was in order to punish Gibeon for willingly becoming a vassal of Israel. And some of the verses in Joshua 10 refer to the people of this coalition as Amorites. And without doubt, not all of these five nations were Amorites per se. However, the Amorites that began as a small and distinct tribe up in Mesopotamia had, because of their aggressive nature, eventually become a very dominant culture. And they had absorbed many other tribes and cultures, and they grew to have such influence in the Middle East that by Joshua's day, to say Amorite is not far off from just saying Westerner, for example, in our modern word. Or as another example, the New Testament Bible deals a great deal with Greek culture, and we still speak of Greek culture to this day. But only a minority of those who were part of the Greek culture in the New Testament were actually ethnic Greek. It was a situation whereby the people of Greece were credited for developing an integrated system of philosophy and theology and language and government that spread far and wide. Nations that adopted that system didn't necessarily come under the rule of Greece, nor did they become ethnic Greeks. They just operated in a popular and very well-known system called by that name. Therefore, we'll find, again in the New Testament, Gentiles who lived under that integrated system of philosophy, language, theology, government, called Greeks. Greeks. But the vast majority didn't come from Greece. They didn't pledge allegiance to Greece. They were talking about a culture. So the term Amorites in the Old Testament is roughly equivalent to the term Greeks in the New Testament. And the terms came more to refer to a common set of cultural values and language than to any kind of a genealogy or nationality. Now, one of the reasons that Adonai Sedeq was so upset by Gibeon kowtowing to Israel was that Gibeon was a great society. It was not some small, helpless group of people. Gibeon was a grouping of actually several cities that were as big as what were called in those days royal cities. Now, royal cities were where the kings of any particular region resided. The royal cities were the largest, the richest, and most fortified. They had the highest walls. If a king had a standing army, the royal city is where it was garrisoned. So for a powerful city-state like Gibeon to run to Joshua seeking to make peace terms even before it was attacked, well, this angered and terrified not only Adonai Sedeq, but many of the scores of kings that ruled throughout Canaan. Interestingly, they felt their first order of business, go figure, was to attack Gibeon to punish it. Well, the coalition that would go against Gibeon consisted of the city-states of Jerusalem, then called Jebus, Hebron, Yarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon. And these were all cities located in the southern part of Canaan. Hebron was about a seven-hour march from Jerusalem. Yarmuth only about 3 hours southwest of Jerusalem. Lachish and Eglon were quite close to one another. They were over near Gaza in the southwest of the land, southwest of Hebron. It seems there was a sense of urgency, and they gathered and they moved towards Gibeon very rapidly. Now, Gibeon must have been caught wholly unprepared by the approach of Adonai Sedeq's forces, so immediately, what did they do? Well, they sought Joshua's intervention on their behalf. Now, I want you to stop and think for a moment. What's happened here? Only days, maybe weeks earlier, Gibeon had deceived Israel. They made a peace treaty with him. Israel decided to make good on the treaty, even though the entire premise for it was a lie. It was against the direct instructions of the Lord. Now, I'm sure it was a total shock to Israel when almost immediately they find themselves in this insane situation in which, due to their unauthorized treaty and a rash vow to God, they're suddenly obligated to put Israeli lives at stake to fight on Gibeon's behalf. I mean, here were a people that God deemed as his enemy, worthy only of destruction, and Israel would now have to move against other enemies, putting themselves at risk to save wicked and pagan Gibeon. I mean, you talk about a lose-lose situation here. But you know, this is where the great lemonade maker operates best. Even though Israel had made a terrible mistake in allying themselves with Gibeon, the Lord decided to use it all for his purposes. After Israel was at first ushered into Canaan over a miraculously plugged up Jordan River, and then after Jericho was taken by a series of supernatural acts by Jehovah, and after the second battle for Ai that just went like clockwork, Israel was wondering where to make their next move to conquer Canaan, just how they would initiate it. Yet, if the conquest of Canaan was going to be the serial attacking of fortified cities throughout the land, one at a time, man, Israel's losses were going to mount. And the amount of time it was going to take, it could easily be generations. No people can sustain a high level of war effort for that long. So the Lord used Gibeon to take that next step. By definition, these five kings who came together to attack Gibeon were kings over royal cities. They each lived and ruled in substantial walled cities. And the cities had nearly impenetrable barriers for defense. And since the method of attacking a walled city was by siege, well, the effort was time-consuming and the casualty rate of the attacking force was always high. Most of the time, siege warfare was more or less about just blockading a city so nobody could go in or go out. And the city's residents couldn't tend their fields or their orchards, so their food supply was limited. The supply of wood for cooking fires was limited. They couldn't entertain merchant traders from other lands that at this point in history were relied upon for very critical items like weapons, salt, medicines, all kinds of things. So it was a waiting game. And the force that surrounded that walled city had the upper hand. Well, the advantage for the king and the residents of the walled city was weather and attrition. If they had planned well enough, if they had stockpiled enough food and weapons, and they had a substantial water source inside of those city walls, and pestilence and disease didn't play too big of a role, it was really difficult for an opposing army to force its way into a city. And as often as not, impatience would lead eventually to an all-out assault on the city, and many of the attacking soldiers would die, such that the conquering force just simply gave up and went home. Well, think back to the battle strategy for Israel against Ai. Because Israel at first came against Ai with way too few troops and then turned tail and ran when Ai fought back, the leaders of Ai fully expected the same sort of thing to happen when Israel tried again. So Joshua turned this expectation to his advantage. You see, the trick is to get the army to come out of the city and into the open. To leave those tall defensive walls, their high ground positions, now they're vulnerable. The military leaders at Ai wanted to strike a serious and demoralizing blow to Israel. So when they felt Israel was just too weak to cause them any real trouble, man, they burst out from behind those thick stone fortress walls. They chased after the Israelite army. Little did they know that another and hidden group of Hebrew soldiers was lying in wait for them so that the Israelite army could then just go into the city. And when the army of Ai left and the ambush was sprung, it was over in hours. So here we have five kings representing five substantial kingdoms in Canaan that were on God's to-do list. Sooner or later, Israel was going to have to do battle with every one of these kingdoms and destroy them in order to occupy the promised land. The Lord simply expedited the process. He used Gibeon as bait. And the five kings made the fatal mistake of taking their armies away from their stronghold defensive positions, away from their walled fortresses, out into the open, for no other reason than to display their anger against some fellow Canaanites, the Gibeonites, who felt that it was wiser to switch sides than to fight Israel. And in an odd irony, Gibeon made that decision because they believed that what the Lord God of Israel said he'd do to all the many Canaanite tribes, he was fully capable of doing. Well, in verse 8, the Lord begins his instruction to Joshua with the much-used phrase, "Fear not." Why would Joshua fear? He was going to be battling the allied armies of five nations simultaneously. Oh, man. And he tells Joshua that the battle to save Gibeon that will pit Israel against the most formidable foes they have yet faced, it's a done deal. It's already decided, Joshua, don't worry about a thing. God had turned those five kings along with their kingdoms over to Israel. Joshua believed God, and that was the key to victory. Now, as surprised as the Gibeonites were at their Canaanite brothers from the south coming to punish them, so were these five kings surprised at this sudden attack upon them by Joshua and his Hebrew army. Now, using the nighttime to their advantage, something that Israel would employ as a strategy often in its history, they traveled from their permanent encampment at Gilgal during the dark hours and launched a surprise attack on the coalition forces of Adonai Sedek. It threw the enemy into a panic. And a fleeing army is both racked with fear and unorganized. And this army was far away from the safety of its 30-foot-high, 10-foot-thick walls back home. Chase was on. The goal of the five armies was to get back to home base and regroup behind those safe walls. Joshua's goal was to prevent it. And while those five armies were out in the open, they could be much more easily dealt with than if Joshua allowed the troops to make it home. They'd have to then use siege warfare, one city at a time, to try and take them. This could take years. So the time to strike was now. So the coalition army fled towards Beit Horon. There was a path through the mountains that might provide an escape path. Beit Horon means the house of caves. And the area was littered with caves. Pretty soon, the five kings was going to try to use one of them to hide from Joshua's forces. Well, Beit Horon was more a region than the name of, like, of a town. And these passages speak of an upper and a lower Beit Horon, or in other words, it was an ascent and a descent. And this place is northwest of Gibeon. Now, upper Beit Horon is high up in the hills. It's about 5 miles from Gibeon. Lower Beit Horon is about a mile and a half further away from that. And as they were in the pass descending out of Beit Horon, the Lord himself smote the army of these five kings with what? Hailstones. And the stones were large enough, and it came upon them so suddenly that more of them died, we're told, from the hailstorm than Joshua killed with the sword. Now it's here in verse 12 that we get one of the more famous and puzzling stories in the entire Bible. It is the story of the day that the sun stood still in the sky and night refused to fall on account of Joshua asking the Lord to make it happen. Now, I want to take a look at this story for a few minutes. First of all, there was a very practical reason that Joshua wanted the daylight to go on longer than normal. Battles always ended at sunset in that era. It was a simple matter of not being able to discern friend from foe. Plus, you know, by the end of a long day of battle, the soldiers were pretty exhausted, and they needed rest and they needed food. Now, in this particular incident, the troops of this five-nation coalition were anxious for the darkness to come, of course, so they could hide, maybe escape from Joshua's clutches. They stood a very good chance of most of them making a stealthy return to their home cities during the nighttime. Now, Joshua understood this, and he realized that by all that was natural, there was simply not going to be enough daylight hours for him to finish the job. The writer of Joshua, who's often referred to as the compiler by Bible academics, says forthrightly that verses 12 and 13 are written in the book of Yasher, or Jasher, as we say in English. In Hebrew, it is the Sefer of Yashar. Now, in English, it is literally the book of the upright, or the book of the righteous. So despite what one might think, Jasar was not somebody's name. Now, the book of Yashar has never been found, but it obviously existed at some point in history. It is said to be a compilation of poems and of war songs, which were just poems, about some of Israel's greatest heroes. Now, I've told you on a number of occasions that the Torah and the Old Testament in general were not written like a daily journal or a diary. Most of the books had a primary author, but probably not even one of them was completed start to finish by the same person. The time frame was just too long. And usually, by the way, if you'll notice it, it was always written in retrospect. So whoever contributed this section of Joshua had some document at his disposal that was called the Book of Yashar, and it must have been pretty popularly known about. Therefore, the form of the quote about the sun standing still is poetry. It's very important we take it in that vein. Exactly how literally we should take it is the issue that has created a multitude of opinions about those two small verses. Now, let me start by saying that to some extent or another, a miracle was involved. There is really no other way to read it or account for it unless we want to simply see it as a Hebrew fairy tale. And by the way, many think that's exactly what it was. The scenario has Joshua asking God to keep the sun and the moon from setting and thus preventing nightfall. How is it that both the sun and the moon are mentioned since it's a daytime event? Well, I think we've all seen that faint glow of the moon up in the sky during the day. And in our current narrative, we have the sun hovering over Gibeon, and to the west over Ayalon was the outline of the moon. The sun was on its decline, the moon was on its ascent. Joshua cried out to God to help him by giving him more daylight hours. God obliged. Now it's interesting to me that in verse 14, that it says there was no day like that day before or after it, and part of the reason for the momentous nature of that day was that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man. That's what made it so special. Now, what makes this interesting is the word hearken. Now, we've discussed this word before. The Hebrew word that is usually translated as hearken or listen is, what's the word? Shema. Shema. Shema does not mean listen. And hearken also is not an outdated English word that means listen. Rather, both of those words, hearken and Shema, mean hear and obey. Hear and obey. It is not a passive word. It's not simply hearing something like listening to the sound of the wind or listening to some music. Rather, it carries with it always a sense of action. The hearing brings the doing. To Shema is to hear something and do. It would be a tad too far, probably, to say that God obeyed Joshua, of course. Yet, poetically speaking, that's sort of the idea that's being brought across here. It is portraying Joshua as having such great standing with the Lord and displaying such perfect obedience that Joshua speaking it causes the Lord to act without deciding the rightness or the wrongness of the request. Now, I think the best way for us to think of it is as it is in Exodus when the Lord explained that as his mediator, when Moses spoke something, we were to take it that it was as if God himself spoke it. When Moses ordered the Nile to turn blood red, he didn't have to go to God. He didn't have to consult with him. And then God turned around and give an order for the river to change color. God put authority into the mouth of Moses such that Moses could order these things using God's power. I believe this is the same sense that is happening here. It is but another way of explaining that when Joshua ordered the sun to set, it was as if God ordered it. The sun not to set. It was as if God ordered it. So, is that what actually happened? Did the earth actually stop rotating for a time, or did its rotation slow way down for a few hours? Taken at its most literal, this is not saying that the sun stayed at its zenith and just stayed there perfectly still. Rather, it's saying that the sun stood in the midst of the sky, meaning it did not reach the horizon, it did not set. And as it says, it did not hasten, it didn't hurry. towards the horizon, so the day would become night. Now, there are scholars who think that since this is poetry, and without doubt it is poetry, then we can rightfully view it a little bit differently. For instance, there are those days when the hours seem to fly by so fast, and we have something so critical that we have to accomplish, it seems to us as if time is just sped up. There are other times when we can look at a task that must be accomplished today, and we see there's just no way we're going to get it done today. It isn't going to happen. But we begin, and lo and behold, somehow, it seems like we did 12 hours worth of work in 8. And using poetic license, that could have been the case here in Joshua. The long or the short of it is that while it is possible for the Lord to stop the earth from rotating, the sun from setting, the moon from rising, I find that because of the type of literature used, that it is virtually acknowledged in the passages themselves that this is a story from the book of Jasher, a book of war songs and poetry, and that the effects worldwide of the earth suddenly stopping its rotation, you would think would be mentioned elsewhere in history and in legend, would have been as universal as we hear about the worldwide flood in so many different societies. But none exists. And indeed, practically every society uncovered, as I think you already know, has a great flood narrative. I'm not at all dogmatic about how this event came about. A miracle wrought by God is just fine with me. I'm satisfied just kind of leave it where it lies. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what we're going to do. We'll get through Joshua 10 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.